You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after a spike in COVID-19 cases, UW-Madison is moving all classes online and quarantining certain students for 2 weeks. We'll talk about how the virus can spread in dense populations and take your health questions about the coronavirus. Now, the party conventions are over. In past typical election years, pollsters might see a bump in popular opinion following the marquee nominating events of the election cycle. But 2020 has not been a typical election year in some ways. Between the COVID-19 pandemic, the virtual conventions, the inability to do normal on-the-road campaigning, candidates and pollsters are in some uncharted waters. We're going to take a look at the latest national and state polling now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching the polls? What do you think about what you're seeing? What are your concerns? Do you care about polls? And do you have questions about how it all works? Join in at 800-642-1234. Harry Enten is a senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. Harry, welcome back.
I just want to say that I do care about the polls, so that's at least one person out of the 300 plus million people in this country who does care about them.
Well, that's good, because I was on the edge of my seat wondering, Harry, if you cared about polling. Well, I don't know. I didn't know from past experience which way you'd go on that. I'll take that off on my...
the whole coronavirus pandemic has changed all of our minds and a lot of different things, but I just wanted you to know on that particular topic, I'm as steady as they come.
Excellent. That's good to hear. Well, let's look at this idea of a convention bump. What does it look like in the past? Do we see it this year?
Yeah, I mean, look, here's the deal. Usually the candidates get a lot of attention, a lot of positive attention during the conventions. And so normally what you will see is a slight bump in their popularity, a slight bump in their polling numbers. And then it oftentimes recedes the further out you get from a convention, although sometimes it doesn't. This particular year, however, no real bumps. Joe Biden was ahead nationally by, say, around 8-9 points going into the conventions. And now he's up at around by around 8 points, maybe a slight degradation of his advantage, but still has a clear lead, at least nationally.
What do you make of that? Is it because we had these virtual conventions and they weren't as exciting, or do conventions not matter as much as they used to?
I think it's probably a little bit of both, right? I mean, look, it was a very interesting production. Certainly the folks who were behind it had their work cut out for them doing something that wasn't normally done. But it's also the case that over the past few cycles, as candidates have become better known earlier on in the cycles, as we have the internet, 24-hour cable news, the amount of bounce that you have been seeing over the past few cycles has certainly been more limited than, say, it was in the past.
Some people have pointed toward past election campaigns where the conventions were kind of a turning point, where the lead changed after the convention and locked in on that new look. Where have we seen that in the past?
Just a few examples, like 1988, Michael Dukakis led going into the conventions. He had a bounce where he was leading by as much as 17 points. People always bring that up to me, especially early on when they say you can't trust the early polls. Things could change. And then obviously after the conventions in 1988, you saw George H.W. Bush take a lead. He never gave up. And then 4 years later, in fact, Bill Clinton was trailing going into the Democratic National Convention. And of course, he took the lead after that convention and went on to defeat the incumbent in that election, George H.W. Bush.
The conventions didn't seem to change the national polls much. Is anything? I mean, this has been a big news year in these United States, and the polls seem to be kind of impervious to that, don't they?
Do they seem impervious or what? My goodness gracious. I mean, you could set your clock to it. There's few things more reliable except for maybe, well, it used to be traffic in New York, but now there is no traffic in New York. Look, the deal is pretty simple. Joe Biden heading into the summer averaged about a 6-point lead. That bumped up a little bit after the killing of George Floyd. It bounced up to maybe around 10 points nationally. But we've seen some mean reversion, some coming back of that lead to maybe about 8 points nationally. But I got to tell you, I look at the polls a lot. You can go back to campaigns dating all the way back since 1940, long before I was alive, long before most of your listeners were alive. And this is the most stable race on record since at least 1940.
Talking about polling and presidential politics with Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. You can join in with your questions, your hopes and fears when you look at the polls, wherever you're coming from. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, we've talked about the national polling, Harry, but you've pointed out to me in the past, we don't have a national election for president. We have the Electoral College. First of all, which states are you watching most closely?
Well, I'll tell you, to be perfectly honest, the one you're situated in right now is pretty gosh darn important. Didn't we learn that lesson 4 years ago when Donald Trump won that state by, I believe it was 0.77 percentage points? I might have gotten it down to the 100s a little bit wrong. It might have been 0.76, but I believe it was 0.77. So I'm looking at Wisconsin. I'm looking at Florida. I'm looking at Pennsylvania. I'm looking at Arizona, Michigan, and North Carolina, basically the six closest swing states that Donald Trump won in 2016. Those are the six I'm looking at most closely. There are a few others like New Hampshire and Nevada that I'm also looking at. But really, those six core battleground states are just so important.
We talked about this a little bit last time you were on, Harry, but I think it's worth tackling again. You know, the polls in 2016 showed a Clinton lead here in Wisconsin. Donald Trump ended up overcoming that on Election Day itself. How do you compare where we are in 2020 with 2016 and the chance that could happen again?
So I think the key difference, well, first off, you know, we can perhaps get into this. You know, obviously, pollsters have changed some of the things that they've done to try and avoid what occurred on the state level in 2016. But I think the key difference is that the national picture is different. That is, at this particular point, Hillary Clinton had about a 3 to maybe 4 point lead in the national polls, a little bit closer to 3. Now Joe Biden has around an 8 point lead nationally. And the fact is, when you get out to that large lead nationally, yes, you can have a difference between, say, the state that ultimately determines the Electoral College winner, like Wisconsin last time with Trump winning it by a point and Clinton winning the national popular vote by 2. But you really can't, once you get outside of, say, a 5 point national lead, it's pretty much impossible to get the situation where you had 4 years ago, where you had one popular vote winner and one Electoral College vote winner. So right now, I would argue the biggest difference that we're seeing is, in fact, in the national polls, not so much in the swing state polls, which actually look kind of similar to as they did 4 years ago at this point.
Well, let's break it down state by state in a few of these. Wisconsin, new Marquette poll coming out. Again, the story there, not much changing. Consistent Biden, modest lead. What are you looking at there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. That's exactly what the case is. The Marquette University Law School poll, Charles Franklin, who I love, I've known him for years, great pollster, was right on in 2018. That's generally reflective of the average. Joe Biden has a little bit larger of a lead in the average than the 4 points there, around 6 or 7 points, depending how you calculate that average. But I think the key nugget that I'm looking at in Wisconsin, as I'm looking throughout the Great Lake battleground states, is the fact, two things. Number one, we see that among white voters nationally, Biden is doing better than Clinton did 4 years ago when you compare the pre-election polls to the pre-election polls. So it's not so surprising that Biden has a slight advantage in a state like Wisconsin. The other thing I'm looking at, which is so important, is voters over the age of 65. This is a group that voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump 4 years ago. And in a state like Wisconsin, in the polling, what are we seeing? We're seeing senior citizens right now going for Joe Biden. That is a key difference. And right now, that is probably the difference between Biden losing in the key swing states and leading in the key swing states, such as Wisconsin.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Minnesota. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Paul?
Well, the reason I don't believe in polls is most of us are out working and don't have the time to do polls, and we're never contacted anyway to do polls.
Paul, thanks for the call. So, Harry, Paul worried that working people, maybe working class people, might be underrepresented consistently in the polls. How do you account for that?
Sure. I mean, there are a few things. Number one, I myself have never actually been called for a poll, at least a political poll, so I get that inclination. What I will say is it is true that white voters, especially white voters without a college degree, which is a very important group in Wisconsin, making up more than 50% of the vote. The same is true in Minnesota, where your caller was calling from. That group doesn't pick up the phone nearly as much four telephone polls as, say, white voters with a college degree. Now, the question is ultimately, can you correct for that? And it turns out that usually you can. You can. The white voters without a college degree who do answer the phone tend generally to be representative of those who don't. Now, that's not always the case. In fact, I would argue in 2016, it wasn't the case. And that was part of the reason the polls were wrong. But you can weight those respondents up who do answer the polls. And to be honest, I can't guarantee that there won't be a polling error. But the fact is, the polls were pretty good in a state like Wisconsin in 2018. They were also pretty good next door in Minnesota. So right now, I'm expecting that they're probably going to be on point. And if they're not, I'm not sure which side will necessarily benefit from the polling error.
Thanks for the call, Paul. And that's there are margins of error on all polls, and that's one of the factors, right? Did our polling accurately represent the voting population of this country or state or whatever unit we're looking at, right?
Yeah, that is certainly part of it. I mean, in fact, I would argue that's an additional error on top of the sampling error that we might normally assume, right? And that's part of the reason why I always talk about something called a true margin of error. And I think this is rather important to point out. The average since 1972 in any particular close state has been off by about plus or minus 3 points on average. But if you were to take a true 95% confidence interval, then the average is off by closer to plus or minus 9 percentage points. Polls are tools. They are a guide to get us close to the truth. Usually the polls are pretty good, but sometimes in 2016, as 2016 showed us, state polls can in fact kick the bucket.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking to Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. He's with us to talk about how polling has been looking during the 2020 election cycle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know more about when it comes to political polling? How much stock do you put into poll numbers? Do you watch them if you feel like you have a stake in this campaign? And do you watch them and, you know, have emotional ups and downs as the numbers move around, or in some cases don't move around? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about polling during the 2020 election season. Harry Enten is with us, senior writer and analyst at CNN Politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch polls closely? Do you get worried when you see numbers going in a way you don't like? Do you have questions about how it works, especially in an unusual election year? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Logan is with us in Green Bay. Logan, hello.
Hi. I don't have much faith in polling. Right now, both sides have a monolithic block, and they're made up the minds. I think the significant number has made up its mind already. And if the election were held today and if the election were held on election day, I think the results are going to be the same. And I like Dr. Franklin's analysis.
Logan, thanks a lot for the call. Logan saying, Harry, people are pretty much locked in at this point. Does polling seem to support that idea?
Say that it certainly does. I mean, the fact is there's a reason why the polls have been so stable over the course of this campaign. It's also the case that opinions of the candidates have been pretty stable. You know, when we're talking about the moving polls this year, we're talking about just a few points. Mm-hmm. And that is just very unusual. Normally you could see wild gyrations, 10, 15, 20 points. Right now we're talking about a 3 or 4 point window. And ultimately, the election is close enough where if you have a small shift towards Trump, he could very well win. But right now, he's not exactly in the position where if the polls stay the same, he would certainly, in my opinion, he would probably be a goner come election day if this is what the polls look like on that day.
Logan, thanks for the call. We've got a Brian in Kenosha County now. Brian, hello.
Yes, hello, Larry. How are you doing?
What did you want to bring up?
I'm listening to these numbers. I don't know how polls are conducted, but I've seen one Biden sign in my travels and at least 100 Trump signs. I was at Great Lakes Dragway over the weekend for the big show. And, I mean, people had Trump masks, Trump shirts, you know, Trump. There was vehicles decorated with, you know, Trump signs. Nothing Biden. I never saw one Biden. I'm almost curious, like, why do they even conduct polls? Is it almost to, you know, sway people's minds, like people that are on the fence or, you know, weak-minded. Or I'm just confused. Like, where are these numbers coming from?
And you Brian, think for thanks, North- thanks a lot for the call. So Brian's seeing a lot of visible signs, and it may be an indication, I don't know, of more enthusiasm. There's been a theory among Trump voters, even if there are more people responding to polls saying they'll vote for Biden.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a lot of enthusiasm for the president of the United States. You know, there's a reason why his numbers have been so steady nationally, right? Even despite a pandemic, despite an economy that certainly is improving from where perhaps the doldrums it was a little bit earlier on in the pandemic, but he has a very solid base of support. That being said, look, polls do call a cross-section of the population. They have been pretty good during the Trump presidency. They were pretty good 2 years ago in Wisconsin, where they showed that Scott Walker was a slight underdog for re-election, and he did lose to Tony Evers by, you know, a little bit more than a point, 2 points. So the polls are pretty good. And the other thing I'll point out is it really does depend on what neighborhoods that you're going to and whether or not you'll be seeing the yard signs, right? You know, if you go in Manhattan, which is where I am currently in New York, you will see that there are, in fact, very few outward support of Trump. But if you, say, go to Staten Island, which is another county in New York State, you'll see a lot more support. So it really does depend on where you go. And that's the purpose of polls, is to try and get a true cross-section of the population. And over time, while polls are not perfect, they come with a margin of error, they're usually pretty close to the point.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Harry Enten from CNN, looking at the latest polling numbers. Back to your calls now. Aaron is with us in Viroqua. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I was just wanting to bring up how it seems like the polling was totally right on for the 2016 election. And I would say, you know, Trump won only by 22,000 votes or so in the state. And yet 275,000 voters in the state were disenfranchised due to voter right laws.
Aaron, thanks for the call. There's a controversial study that came up with that number. But to that point of difficulties in voting, different voter rights laws in different states, Harry, is that something in close elections that can move the needle?
Sure. I mean, obviously, the rules of the game are very, very important. And obviously, as you point out, there have been some studies that suggest that there was, you know, that it might have cost Clinton the election, others that suggest that that's probably not the case. So, you know, certainly that is something that pollsters definitely do need to take into account. It is so important when polling to poll, if you're trying to figure out who's going to win an election, is to poll the people who are the most likely to come out. And if pollsters are not doing that, then, you know, all bets are off. And that is part of the error in why polling can be off, is sometimes you just aren't polling the people who are actually going to turn out and vote. So the hope is this year, through questions, through understanding the likely electorate, that we come close to the truth on who's going to turn out. But there's no guarantee in that.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Gay now in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hi. I'm on a Facebook page where a lot of us have been debating how much, if any, influence the Black Lives Matter movement, not the peaceful part, but the few violent protesters who infiltrated, in my opinion, are going to change the important demographic of suburban white women. I'm not suburban, but I am a white woman. I have a sister who claims that one of her good friends who hates Trump actually will be voting for him because she fears this violence is going to spread to her neighborhood.
Thanks for the call. Gay and her Facebook friends are not the only ones asking these questions, Harry.
No, they're not. And I've certainly done my fair, answered my fair of questions on this, done my fair share of segments. Here's the deal. The deal is certainly that Trump wants to play on this turf, right? He wants to play on the turf of the idea of, oh, the dangerous cities, the protests are getting out of control, they're turning into riots. Right now, it is the case that Trump certainly does better on the issue of crime than he does, say, on the issue of the coronavirus. But he's still doing remarkably poorly among white voters and suburban voters. In fact, he is doing more poorly among white voters right now than in any pre-election polling, at least the aggregate of it, before the election day itself, for any Republican since 1996. So right now, it's certainly the case that it could change the course of the election, but we haven't seen it change the course of the election yet.
Thanks for the call. Tom joins us now in Crandon. Tom, hi.
Well, hi. How are you doing? Well, I disagree with what Harry, is that his name?
That's right.
That is my name.
Not voting for, oh, okay, whoever just spoke last and said white Americans are not, I think he's a little confused. Now, I want to talk about the polling system. The polling system, I'm a retired school teacher up here in Cranston for 35 years, and I was conservative all those years, and that was not easy. I was not the only one in our staff that was that way, but we were the minority. But the simple fact of the matter is, I have never, never in my life been called to ask who I'm going to vote for or what I'm going to do or the election process. But the fact of the matter is, no, I drove my son got married, an ex-Marine, down in Green Bay. And if you do the math and do the mileage from Cranston to Green Bay, I drove one direction down to Green Bay to my son's wedding, which was on Saturday.
We just have a couple minutes left. Not sure you're going with that, Tom, but I want to give Harry a chance to tackle that question again. He says, conservative, never been polled.
I mean, look, as I said, I've never been polled either. A lot of people have been called. You know, a good statewide poll is probably getting 600 to 900 people in it at most. So it shouldn't be that surprising that a lot of people haven't been called. But what I will say again is that, you know, Joe Biden's base in the state of Wisconsin is going to be highly reliant on Green Bay and then down to Milwaukee and then jumping across to Madison. And so that vote is going to be pretty concentrated. So it wouldn't be so surprising to me if you go across the rural areas in the north that you might not see as many Biden signs as you do Trump signs.
Thanks for the call. Our last 30 seconds, Harry, a couple other states we should be watching apart, of course, from Wisconsin.
I will just say that right now, the clearest path to Biden to getting 270 electoral votes is Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, and then Nebraska's second congressional district. You add those to the Clinton states, you get to 270. The final thing I'll note is if Joe Biden wins in Florida on election night, Donald Trump's chance are basically nil. If Trump wins in Florida on election night, this election, with the counting that we have going on with mail-in ballots, may take a little while to determine who wins.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Harry Enten is a senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. He joined us today for a look at the latest polling in the presidential race, what's happening in battleground states, and how polling has worked in this unusual election year. Coming up, we'll look at how COVID-19 spreads at large gatherings, including college campuses, and answer some of your COVID-related questions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend and kick off Bike Week here in the state. Get some advice for scenic rides around Wisconsin and share your own favorites. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, UW-Madison is responding to a sharp uptick in COVID-19 cases by holding all classes online for the next 2 weeks. It's also quarantining students in two of its largest dorms. Yesterday's announcement came on the fifth day of classes. The student positivity rate was at least 20% on Monday and Tuesday, 13% yesterday. Public health officials say there are at least 46 outbreaks tied to UW-Madison. Other UW campuses are seeing increases in COVID as well. Meanwhile, a model from San Diego State University estimates that 19% of all U.S. coronavirus cases in August could be traced back to the Sturgis motorcycle rally in South Dakota. South Dakota's governor called the report fiction, saying it's built on faulty assumptions and was not peer-reviewed. Mary Beth Graham is an infectious disease specialist with the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's also medical director of infection prevention and control at Frederick Hospital. Dr. Graham, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, first of all, let's start with what we're seeing on campuses. What's your reaction to news, not just here in Wisconsin, but on campuses around the country that are seeing big increases in COVID as they come back to school?
I guess I don't want to sound flippant by saying it this way, but this isn't unexpected. We know that this virus is circulating in the community. We know that it is incredibly easily transmitted. We also know that the average college student is probably unlikely to follow a lot of the mitigation, you know, things that they're supposed to do with regards to with social distancing, gathering, wearing a mask, et cetera. So having my youngest child is actually a UW-Madison student. And 2 weeks ago when we were there on campus, there were students everywhere, all over, out in the green areas, no mask in sight, playing Frisbee, running around, having fun, no social distancing. They're doing what college students do. So it's just not unexpected. And the two dorms at UW-Madison typically have a large number of freshmen in them. So it's the two that I read about online that are there that are quarantined. Again, it doesn't surprise me. It's disappointing because one would hope that there would have been a little bit more attention to the recommendations for social distancing and wearing a mask, et cetera. But I'm not surprised.
This is campuses, but there are other super spreader events, so-called, that we've seen around the country. Are you, I guess, dismayed that we haven't gotten the lesson? Like, if we wore the masks, if we social distance better, try to be outside more than inside, that kind of thing, we could be making a difference in all this, right?
So there's a lot about COVID right now that, again, having watched this closely, been involved in a number of trials and monitoring and taking care of patients from the beginning. The virus has changed over the last 6 to 9 months. I mean, since basically in January when we were looking at this. And there's a couple of different ways to look at it. We know the virus isn't going to go away. So anybody who says it's just going to go away just needs to quit saying that, because it's not. But the virus has changed, and the manifestations and the presentations that we are seeing have definitely changed from early on in the pandemic. If you look at laboratory confirmed COVID-19 associated hospitalizations, those are going down fairly steadily over the last several months, where I think right now, at least on the CDC website, it's about the rate per 100,000 population was down to about 3, whereas you had previously it was up in the 10, 12, 15 range. So, I mean, that's actually a good sign that the virus actually has changed. There are different strains that are circulating, much more transmissible than the earlier strains that we saw, but we're seeing a different demographic. So we're seeing younger people getting ill, but we still have to worry about those individuals potentially exposing those whose immune systems may not be as healthy. And even with the young people, we're still seeing young people who can have severe cases, have significant complications, and can also still die from this. So it shouldn't be taken lightly. I mean, I worry about students who get this and they're like, oh, I just had a fever for a day or two. It was no big deal. And then other students like, yeah, I don't need to worry about this and go out. There's going to be, potentially there are those people that don't have that as their response to being affected with the virus. That's why, again, everybody working together to try to prevent spread is so important.
Now, on what I think might be an upside here, have we learned a lot since the early sort of nightmare scenario in the New York metropolitan area about preventing the rapid spread in senior centers, health facilities, especially for older or other vulnerable populations? It seems like we've gotten better at that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the state of Wisconsin has has some really nice protocols outlined where, again, they look at, these are some of our most vulnerable populations, and they have protocols put together where employees are screened on a routine basis for who work in congregate settings, whether it's a skilled nursing facility, nursing home, et cetera. Because again, you don't want somebody who's asymptomatic, who could come in and then potentially spread, and then much better adherence and knowing now. I mean, early on in the pandemic, we weren't doing universal, what we call PPE or personal protective equipment. And now for all patient-facing encounters in healthcare, it essentially is at a minimum, surgical mask, eye protection or goggles, not just eyeglasses and gloves, and also always making sure that you do very, very, very good hand hygiene. Early on, that wasn't what we were doing because early on, I mean, and many physicians and physicians at CDC, Dr. Fauci has said this, I've said this, we were wrong at the beginning because we thought this virus was going to be very similar to influenza, where it was mostly droplet, the 6 feet, you could manage it for, if you were less, you know, more than 6 feet, there wouldn't be an issue. Then we learned that, no, this virus actually does have the potential in some scenarios to remain viable in smaller droplets that can remain in the air longer and travel further than that 6 feet. So much has been learned about this virus. And again, I think one of the most telling scenarios was the choir thing in Washington State from several months ago, where one person was sick and so many people became ill. And I remember after that, a lot of us, my infectious disease colleagues, we all looked at each other and said, oh man, this is not like flu. It doesn't spread like that. And then again, further studies were done in terms of how it could be spread. So the knowledge curve about this virus, how it's spread, what you can do to do mitigation has just exploded. The amount of data that's out there, the articles that have been written, it's fascinating. As a healthcare professional, it's fascinating to live through this and see this accumulation of data. And then also on the science side, looking at it in terms of what do we know about this virus? How can we fight it? What therapeutics can we use? How do we go after the vaccine, et cetera? It's really an amazing time in, at least, again, for medical professionals, it's an amazing time to be in the midst of this and to watch this evolve.
Talking to Dr. Mary Beth Graham, infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, also with Friedrich Hospital, talking about latest on COVID-19, how it spreads, big spreading potential events. You can join in with your questions, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. What I remember hearing about a while ago is the COVID-19 virus will die on dry fabrics or even dry surfaces in about 24 hours. But I have a scenario for you. I went to five places yesterday. So in my car, if I picked up COVID-19 somewhere and I go out driving tomorrow, how likely is the COVID-19 that might be in my car? How likely is that still be alive in the damp, because of the damp weather we had yesterday?
Dennis, thanks for the call. A lot of questions about still the idea of surface transmission and picking it up from surfaces. Dr. Graham, what do we know about that in general and his scenario, I guess, in particular?
No, I thank you for the question. So there has been a lot written about the viability of the virus on different types of surfaces, whether it's cardboard versus plastic versus something else. But the only way that that virus actually is going to get into you and infect you is if you touch those surfaces and then touch your nose or your mouth. So the way I've chosen to look at it is, it's not so much that they'll be on a surface, but you should always think about, after you touch something, before you touch your face and your mouth, you should do some type of hand hygiene. I keep a bottle of alcohol hand sanitizer in my car. After I'm in at the grocery store and I come out and put everything in my car, as soon as I get in the car, I alcohol hand sanitize, then I come on home and everything's good. After I put up my groceries, I do that. And I'm very thoughtful about, am I going to be going near my mouth or my nose? Because that's how you're going to get exposed to it. So even from the, you know, you could sit there and say there'd be many scenarios, how long does it live? That becomes an irrelevant question if you remember the only way that you are going to get it into an area where then it could take hold is if it gets to one of your mucous membranes, your mouth, your nose. So it's those hands. It's that hand sanitizing before you go close to your face.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about how COVID-19 spreads at large gatherings and elsewhere. Dr. Mary Beth Graham is with us, infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, also medical director of infection prevention and control at Friedrich Hospital. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about the rise in COVID-19 cases on college campuses? Are you on one of those campuses now as a student yourself or faculty or staff? What's going on where you are? Are you worried? Was it a mistake to come back at all, or was it a good choice, do you think? And do you have general COVID-related questions for our guest doctor? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the spread of COVID-19 with Dr. Mary Beth Graham, infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and medical director of infection prevention and control at Friedrich Hospital. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID, how it works, how it spreads, and how we can stop the spread? Anything you've been wondering about masks, potential vaccines, and more? Have you been avoiding big crowds, indoors or outdoors? Have you tried to hold a gathering of some sort? How did you do it? And what do you think of what's going on campuses, especially if you are on a campus now yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls. Andrew is with us in Whitewater. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Andrew?
So one of the questions that I wanted to ask was if the doctor who's on right now, if she happens to know what the death rate in nursing homes was and what percentage of the death nationwide that accounts for. And the other question or point that I have is, given that nursing homes were locked down almost immediately, how effective of a, I guess, preventative measure is that when we've seen what's happened with infection rates and death rates in nursing homes?
Thanks for the call, Andrew. Dr. Graham, nursing homes and COVID.
So the biggest issue with nursing homes initially, especially early on in the pandemic, is that there was spread within the facilities, and essentially patients were kept there when they were sick early on, but not sick enough to go to the hospital. So then more people became ill. So in terms of death rates that are split out to that, I mean, the CDC has some of the best data, if you want to look at it, to look at death rates and the ages of those individuals which have been affected. I've never seen a table that specifically comes out and splits it out according to was a nursing home resident versus not. They do have it by age. They do have it by gender. They do have it by race. There's a lot out there. But a lot of the, again, the initial issues with the nursing homes were in a congregate setting, and it's basically a closed environment, and you had people there. It was just incredibly unfortunate at the beginning of the pandemic. A lot of the facilities changed what they do. So I know that some of our facilities around here were very, very quick that they actually had COVID. They switched and had COVID units so people weren't sick enough to go to the hospital. They changed the PPE that they wear there. So the employees changed what they did. They were very, very, quick to, after we had additional information about the virus, to change some of those practices. We did not see here what was originally seen in Washington State or what was seen in New York State. But again, I apologize. I haven't seen anything specifically from nursing homes, but if you look at populations, the age, yes, the older patients, the more debilitated patients, those typically would be patients that would be in that demographic. They have had some of the highest rates of attack rates, but also death.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Sarah with us in Eau Claire. Sarah, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring? Tell us about?
Yeah, I'm a student at Eau Claire currently and UW-Eau Claire, and our current issue is off-campus students who are going out to the bars. And I was wondering if there's a way that campuses can control off-campus students so that we can lessen the spread that way.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Graham, do you have thoughts anyway?
Actually, I heard somebody, it was a blurb on one of the, when I was flopping through and going through on my computer, and it said, essentially, open the schools and close the bars. I mean, essentially that was the recommendation. And I love that mantra, and that's still my mantra. I saw it several months ago. It's very, very difficult to control human behavior. It's just hard to control. I mean, you can tell everybody what the right thing to do is, but making people do that's unclear. Some colleges have very, very strict disciplinary actions because if they're finding out, I mean, I've read reports of students being suspended for school for a semester, but still paying for that semester at different places. You know, the schools can do what they, you know, are going to have those rules out there, but it's hard. I hate to say it. I mean, people need to be altruistic. It's not about them. You know, it's not about you. You're doing this for other people. So again, when people do this, you're ruining it for somebody else. And I've seen some interviews with students at campuses who are very upset saying, you know, other people who wouldn't follow the rules ruined it for the rest of us. My son he's the son of an infectious disease physician. So he knows all about this. And I mean, he's ticked. That at Madison, everything has gone back to online learning. And it's the frustration of, again, it's other people think more about themselves than they do think about those around. Actually, just as an aside, I'm just going to throw this in here. And I shared this earlier with somebody. Back with the 1918 influenza pandemic, there was a news article in Alaska in one of the newspapers there that said the do's and don'ts of influenza prevention. But one of the things was do not neglect your mask was on there. Do not disregard the advice of a specialist just because you don't understand. Do not disregard the rights of a community. Obey cheerfully the rules issued by the authorities. Do not think you are entitled to special privileges. I mean, those are three of the things that people were saying and publishing back in 1918. And if we think back to 1918, there were almost 50 million deaths worldwide from the, you know, H1N1 Spanish flu. So again, they were wearing masks. They were doing a lot of things that we're trying to do here. And I'm presuming they had the same things we're dealing with. Is it people who just didn't think it related to them everybody else can do that, but it doesn't apply to me. It applies to all of us.
So we got another caller now. Jane is with us in Brookfield. Jane, hello.
Hi. My question is, if you can catch the virus at more than 6 feet, why do we keep persisting to say 6 feet? Why aren't we saying 8 to 10 feet?
Interesting. Dr. Graham?
No, that's a great question. It's absolutely a great question. So the issue is the way that so the 6 feet that they talk about, the way that we are mitigating that, it's the masking. So we want people to be wearing masks when they're in groups of people that they otherwise don't normally work with or live with. So if you're at home, you don't need to do it. But in essence, when you're in the grocery store wearing the mask there, if you go to church wearing a mask while you're in church, regardless of how far away you are from somebody else, et cetera. Not everybody, so not all instances with the virus being spread, does it spread more than the 6 feet. Again, they talk about a lot depends on how loud somebody's talking. Yelling potentially can project those respiratory droplets further than just the 6 feet of normal talking. And then there are some people, you'll read about it, they're referred to as super shedder or super spreader. It's referred to as both events, where you may have somebody who has a really large viral load, but it's much easier that for those individuals, there's just something about when they are either talking or singing or doing something that the droplets spread further. So the mitigation for that is the mask. And the issue of the masking in the outside of a hospital setting, I mean, we wear them all the time. All of our patient-facing procedures, we're wearing a mask. But they've learned more about what type of mask in the community are much more effective. So the gaiters, essentially, which pull up from your neck, those are not recommended as a really good way to prevent those respiratory droplets from spreading. If possible, the cloth mask that you wear should have a minimum, but actually optimally, three layers. So if it's the two layer and you can put the filter in between, or a minimum of a three layer mask, that's what has been recommended most recently. Again, those are evolving recommendations that are out there, but those, that's really the biggest issue, again, with helping that. So whether it's the 6 feet, the 26 feet, whatever it ends up being, wearing those masks, especially inside. Outside, it's a little bit different. Again, if there's groups of people, like an outdoor wedding, I would still say, please wear your mask.
And but I have to jump in there, Dr. Graham. We are all out of time. Thanks so much to our guest, Dr. Mary Beth Graham from the Medical College of Wisconsin and Frederick Hospital, joining us with some of the latest answers to questions about COVID. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the genetic editing technology called CRISPR is raising questions and possibilities of treatments. We'll find out more with the creator of a new documentary and a Wisconsin bioethics expert. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.